I called Lee Gelernt of the ACLU and asked him, you know, to what extent are the issues that are affecting all Central American asylum speakers in the United States affecting indigenous language speakers? He said, it's enormous. They're disproportionately affected. All of the problems that Spanish language asylum seekers face are exacerbated if they speak Mayan languages. So just to give one example, when we were speaking on the phone, Lee Gelernt of the ACLU told me that of the kind of worst cases of families that were separated at the border under Trump's zero tolerance policy, and I will remind everyone that that policy is officially over, but the separations are ongoing. At least 900 families have been separated since the official end of that policy over a year ago. But Lee Gelernt of the ACLU told me that of those over 4,000 families that were separated and one parent at least was deported back to Guatemala, their country of origin, without their child, of those 4,000 cases, Lee Gelernt of the ACLU estimated that 10 to 20% affected Mayan language-speaking Guatemalans. That's an enormous, that's not just of the Guatemalan asylum seekers, that's of all of the families separated. So the kind of scale of the problem was what most surprised me when I began reporting this story.
Rachel Nolan's piece in The New Yorker is A Translation Crisis at the Border. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. Odilia Romero is a Zapotec interpreter with the Binational Front of Indigenous Organizations. For the full conversation, go to democracynow.org. Monday, Dr. Martin Luther King special.
You have been listening to Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez, and you are about to be listening to the KBOO Evening News, a volunteer-produced newscast, and you are always listening to 90.7 FM KBOO Portland. That's K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM. The KBOO Evening News is coming up after these short messages.
Join us on Tuesday, January 21st for Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years. A day of special programming looking back at the Trump regime, what happened, why, and the repercussions domestically and internationally. We'll focus on national policy, foreign policy, privacy and surveillance, policing, immigration, labor rights, confronting white nationalism, the environment, and much more. Again, that's Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years on Tuesday, January 21st from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. here on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
I'm Shahid Hamid, KBOO board member. Join the World Arts Foundation and KBOO Radio as we pay homage to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's the 35th anniversary of Keep Alive the Dream, Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center. This year, we will be joined by international opera star Angela Brown and straight from America's Got Talent, Danielle Damon. That's Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Or listen live on KBOO Radio or view it on Open Signal Community Television.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, county commissioners have chosen an interim representative for West Portland in the Oregon legislature.
A high-profile U.S. youth climate lawsuit has been dismissed.
And in international news, experts have confirmed a stolen painting found in Italy is authentic.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 17th, 2020. I'm Clara Shotto.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Multnomah County Commissioners have chosen Democratic real estate developer Akasha Lawrence Spence to represent West Portland in the Oregon legislature during the upcoming 35-day session and through the end of the year. The seat became vacant when House Majority Leader Jennifer Williamson resigned at the end of last year to focus on running for Secretary of State. Lawrence Spence was one of the two nominees who had not filed to run for the position in the May Democratic primary. This worked in her favor, as all five county commissioners said they wanted to select a so-called placeholder or interim candidate for the job. Commissioners cited Lauren Spence's work in the community and the perspective she would bring as one of the only two black women in the legislature. Lauren Spence founded her own real estate development firm and serves on the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission. She told commissioners she, quote, is someone who has been dedicated her entire life to service, end quote. She also said, a vote for me is a vote for the marginalized, for the underrepresented, a voice for the future, end quote.
Representative Alyssa Kenny-Guyer announced Thursday that she will not be seeking another term in the Oregon House of Representatives after 10 years. This makes her at least the 16th Oregon lawmaker to announce they will not be running again, either because they are retiring from politics or running for another office. 12 of those 16 lawmakers are Oregon House members. Kenny-Guyer is the House Human Services and Housing Chair and took a break last year from legislating to fight thyroid cancer. She did not say in the announcement why exactly she will not be seeking re-election. Kenny-Guyer wrote to supporters, quote, there are many other issues that I care about, the climate crisis, gun safety, education, campaign finance, and revenue reform. I look forward to working on these issues and whatever capacity comes next.
Governor Kate Brown has named an experienced writer and litigator to the Oregon Court of Appeals seat that she previously awarded to her own lawyer without considering any other candidates. After controversy erupted, Misha Isaac, Brown's general counsel, declined the appointment. On Friday, Brown named Jacqueline Kamens to the position. Kamens is a private practice attorney who previously served as a senior assistant attorney general in the Oregon Department of Justice and litigated civil matters at the international law firm in Washington, D.C. While working for the Justice Department, she negotiated an agreement that made Oregon one of the first states in the country to cover transgender health care services for its employees. In addition to her legal practice, Kamens also teaches as an adjunct law professor at Lewis and Clark Law School. Kamens succeeds Judge Erica Hadlock, who recently retired from the court. Hadlock replaced now Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum on the appellate court in 2011.
Secretary of State Bev Clarno rejected a pro-forestry initiative filed for the November ballot. Clarno said that the initiative violated a constitutional clause that says ballot measures can only deal with a single subject. Initiative Petition 54 would have allowed the Board of Forestry to block new forestry regulations that have been enacted by lawmakers or voters before they took effect. The initiative would have required the board to ensure that all forest practice regulations be supported by science and would have permitted only land or timber owners to challenge board determinations. Secretary of State Clarno has already rejected five other ballot measures filed for the November ballot on similar grounds. Three of them would have put new restrictions on logging and timber industry practices, while two were designated to accelerate the state's transition to clean energy, transportation, electrification, and lower carbon emissions. Critics have accused Clarno of abusing her office and playing politics with the initiative process by blocking measures opposed by Republicans and their constituents. Initiative Petition 54 is only one of three pro-forestry initiatives that have been filed for the November 2020 ballot. Clarno approved the other two initiatives, 53 and 54. They would require the state to compensate landowners when they pass regulations that restrict the use of their land. They would also remake the Board of Forestry to give it a more pro-logging, pro-industry makeup. Critics have called Petition 53 the child of Measure 37, a controversial 2004 ballot measure that required the state or local government to compensate property owners when new environmental or land use regulations restricted the use of their property. However, another measure passed in 2007 rescinded virtually the entirety of Measure 37, and critics now say Initiative 53 is raising the same issue again.
A federal appeals court has ordered the dismissal of a high-profile youth climate change lawsuit against the U.S. government. The court found it was beyond the power of a federal court judge to order or design a remedial plan for a problem that requires complex policy decisions. A divided three-member panel on the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals reluctantly decided that the case must instead be made to the nation's politicians or voters. The majority opinion said, quote, There is much to recommend the adoption of a comprehensive scheme to decrease fossil fuel emissions and combat climate change, both as a policy matter in general and as a matter of national survival in particular. But it is beyond the power of an Article III court to order, design, supervise, or implement the plaintiff's requested remedial plan, end quote. The panel ordered U.S. District Judge Ann L. Aiken of Oregon to dismiss the case. 5 years ago, 21 young people sued the government asserting a constitutional right to a sustainable climate. They wanted the federal court to order the U.S. to prepare an energy plan that transitions the nation away from fossil fuels. Eugene attorney Julia Ann Olson, who represents the youth named in the case, said that they will ask for a review of the decision by the full Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals.
The Washington County Sheriff's Office announced on Thursday that it had served a search warrant on Catlin Gable School as part of its criminal investigation into allegations of sexual and physical abuse by staff members over the past 3 decades. The agency served the warrant to the private school on Monday. The document has been sealed at the request of investigators. Last month, the school released an internal investigation that detailed repeated instances of sexual abuse by former faculty members. The report specifically named 6 former staff members and accused them of groping, fondling, and having sexual intercourse with students. The report also described 3 other cases of sexual abuse without naming the perpetrators. Officials at Catlin Gable said they provided the internal report to the Washington County Sheriff's Office in November. Prosecutors only have so long to file charges. According to legal experts, it's likely too late to file criminal charges in many of the cases, which date back to the 1970s and 1980s.
The board at Mount Hood Community College have voted to cut 7 of the school's programs. The programs that will be phased out are automotive maintenance and light repair, broadcasting, business technology, cosmetology, environmental health and safety, practical nursing, and wilderness leadership and experiential education. Mount Hood Community College announced in a news release that they are $2.8 million in debt, and phasing out of these programs will save the school money. Dr. Lisa Scari, the college president, said, quote, "Our community looks to us to keep education affordable, relevant, and accessible. That means we have to make these tough decisions now," end quote. The Mount Hood Associated Student Government said in a statement that while the cuts are unfortunate, they support phasing out the programs to limit tuition hikes. The statement added, quote, "The Associated Student Government supports keeping our college as accessible and open as possible, and substantial tuition increases would create a barrier to student success," end quote. According to the college, the cuts will not affect current students, and instead the phased out programs would stop admitting new students.
A panel commissioned by Governor Kate Brown to try to improve outdoor recreation in Oregon has suggested creating an Oregon Outdoors Pass and getting more diversity in wild spaces. The governor's task force on the outdoors is made up of 33 people and released the draft report on Thursday. Brown's goal was to get input on policies, legislation, and initiatives that could boost Oregon's recreation economy and outdoor participation, especially among young people and underserved communities. Panel members came up with 30 ideas in 5 broad categories, such as accelerating investment and outdoor recreation and catalyzing initiative policies. The group will discuss and refine its recommendations at a meeting on January 23rd in Salem. Final recommendations are expected this spring, and the hope is they will be applied within the next 5 years. One recommendation is to hire more diverse people in state agencies, while another seeks to make state parks more accessible to disabled visitors. Another idea is to look at ways to bridge the gap between state and federal land policies, given that over half of Oregon's outdoors is managed by the U.S. Forestry Service and Bureau of Land Management. The panelists also propose a $100 million fund to improve trails, campgrounds, and other projects through a constitutional amendment.
With only a couple weeks until the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary, 4 senators are being pulled off the campaign trail for the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. With more on the story, it's Lily Bulkley with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
A Senate trial is expected to keep you in Washington in the weeks leading up to the Iowa caucuses here. How big of a problem is that for you as you're making your closing pitch to voters here?
Look, some things are more important than politics.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is one of four Democrats running for president tied up in Washington for the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump, along with Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, and Michael Bennett of Colorado. Here's Bennett.
Those of us that are running have to make sure we fulfill our responsibilities, our constitutional responsibilities back in Washington at the same time, and I think we can.
Professor of political science at Iowa State, Dirk Diem, says the trial won't necessarily be bad for the campaigns. The senators will get lots of press after each session. But with the upcoming Iowa caucuses and New Hampshire primaries,
it does leave the other candidates free rein to campaign.
The president himself will be in the Hawkeye State Monday night for a campaign rally. His Republican primary challengers have also been campaigning in Iowa and New Hampshire, former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, and here's former Illinois Congressman Joe Walsh.
It's our goal to have people wake up the day after Iowa and say, oh my God, that's interesting. Joe Walsh did pretty well in Iowa. There is a race.
Yesterday, Walsh's complaints about the 10 states that canceled their Republican primaries, most recently Wisconsin, were ignored again, this time in person at the Republican National Committee's headquarters.
Here's what's weird and just wrong. I'm a lifelong Republican. I'm a former Republican congressman. I'm a Republican candidate for president, and here I was today at Republican headquarters in D.C. to talk about the disenfranchisement of Republican voters, and nobody here would talk to me.
Meanwhile, just before the trial opened, the Senate passed the new NAFTA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, the day after President Trump signed phase one of a trade deal with China. Warren and Klobuchar gave their rationales for voting for the USMCA on this week's debate stage.
It will give some relief to our farmers. It will give some relief to our workers. I believe we accept that relief. We try to help the people who need help. And we get up the next day and fight for a better trade deal.
These are real people hurt by Donald Trump's trade war.
Sanders joined 10 other senators who voted against incremental change in trade policy, including three former 2020 presidential candidates, Kamala Harris of California, Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, and Cory Booker of New Jersey.
We could do much better than a Trump-led trade deal. This deal, and I think the proponents of it acknowledge, will result in the continuation of the loss of hundreds of thousands of good-paying jobs as a result of outsourcing.
Plus, he says, it doesn't mention the words climate change. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. Then at 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali, and at 7, The Struggle. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 40 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy in the morning, then cloudy in the afternoon with a high of 49 degrees. Today in history, in 1997, the Republic of Ireland grants a divorce for the first time. The first divorce was granted to a terminally ill man who wanted to marry his new partner. The quote of the day is from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who said, quote, "Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter."
The Trump administration is attempting to roll back school nutrition standards that were championed by Michelle Obama. A rollback of the standards has been long sought by food manufacturers and some school districts that have balked at the cost of fresh fruits and vegetables. The proposed rule, which coincidentally was announced on Mrs. Obama's birthday, would give schools more flexibility in how much fruit is offered during breakfast. It would also allow schools more choice in the types of vegetable offerings in meals, and it would broaden the definition of what counts as a snack. The new rule has been applauded by food companies, but criticized by nutritionists. The Agriculture Department said the changes reflected requests made over the past 2 years by those who serve meals to children throughout the school year. The department plans to release regulatory analysis over the public comment period on January 21st. The proposal is the department's second attempt to roll back nutrition standards promoted through the 2010 Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act. That act required schools serve children fruits and vegetables every day and offer more whole grain foods and fat-free or low-free milk or low-fat milk. It also required school meals providers limit calories and reduce saturated fat, trans fat, and sodium. This new rule is one of the two agricultural department's plans to propose next week. The other would give meal providers more flexibility under the summer meal programs.
The governor of Utah has stopped an HIV prevention campaign because he does not like the design on the packaging for condoms the health department was handing out. The Utah Department of Health Prevention's Treatment and Care Program wanted to distribute 100,000 condoms to help lower HIV transmission. The condom distribution is one part of the larger The H is for Human campaign. The department hired advertising from firm Love Communications to create sex-positive puns to print on the packaging so people would take them and talk about them. One pun said, quote, "Explore Utah's caves," with an image of a cavern. Another quote read, "Put your arch into it," on top of an image of the state's famous Arches National Park. A spokesperson for Republican Governor Gary Herbert said, quote, "The governor understands the importance of the Utah Department of Health conducting a campaign to educate Utahns about HIV prevention. He does not, however, approve of the use of sexual innuendo as part of a taxpayer-funded campaign, and our office has asked the department to rework the campaign's branding."
Tribal leaders express unity at a Great Sioux Nation address, and Montana officers say finding a missing Native teen is a priority. With that story and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Representatives from several tribal governments in the Northern Plains hope the Great Sioux Nation Address unifies Osheti Shakoin once again. The historic meeting took place in Fort Pierce, South Dakota, as Lee Strubinger reports.
Before tribes in the Northern Plains were split up into reservations, Rosebud Sioux Tribal Chairman Rodney Bordeaux says the tribes would counsel together in the past. It was a strong coalition of Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota tribes, he says.
But this will, the Osheti Shakoin, the reunification of that will just make us stronger in terms of getting what we need to get done, serving our peoples, and making us the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota a strong nation again. And it's possible. So we just laid the groundwork for it again. I know a lot of my ancestors that have gone on before me always wanted to do this, so I'm just playing a small part in making this happen, and it's going to happen.
Representatives from tribal governments within the states of South and North Dakota and Montana all attended. A lot of the issues brought up by different representatives were similar, from infrastructure to human trafficking, the infiltration of meth, and the shortfalls of health care. Treaty rights were also a central topic. Lower Brule Sioux Tribal Chairman Boyd Gourneau was first elected to that tribal council in 1987. He says he's never seen unity as it exists now.
But, you know, I just don't like it when they put us in situations where we're at a constant struggle, just a survival at our own reservations, where we don't have time to do what we're doing now, unified. And that's what we need, and that's what we need to do moving forward, I hope.
South Dakota state lawmakers say they'd like to meet with tribal representatives again to discuss how the state and tribes can work together. I'm Lee Strubinger in Fort Pierre.
Multiple agencies are continuing to search for a missing Native American teen from South Central Montana, even through frigid weather. Olivia Reingold has more.
A multi-agency search team looked for Selena Shelley Faye Not Afraid around the Interstate 90 eastbound rest stop between Hardin and Billings Wednesday. Bighorn County Undersheriff Mike Fuss and about 25 other law enforcement officers searched for leads starting at 8 a.m. when the high was 1 degree Fahrenheit.
As you get out there and start walking, I thought, you warm up pretty quick. So
And I think the adrenaline of hoping you're going to find her and she's going to pop up and say hi to you or something, you know.
16-year-old Not Afraid was last seen at the Fly Creek rest area on I-90 on New Year's afternoon. A search began that evening. That was 15 days ago. Now multiple agencies on the federal, state, and local levels are involved, including the Bighorn County Sheriff's Office and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The Bureau of Land Management joined the search this week. A Montana sheriff recently called Not Afraid's disappearance suspicious-looking in nature. Bighorn County Undersheriff Fuss says volunteers from the community started their search New Year's Day and went home either Monday or Tuesday as temperatures lowered toward zero and below. Fuss says he worked a 28-hour day after Not Afraid was reported missing. He says his office is investigating 5 or 4 other cases, including the disappearance of Hub Williamson, a Native American man who went missing last April.
She's been our priority. I mean, we need to find her.
Fuss says he's hopeful his agency and others will find Not Afraid. On Wednesday, U.S. Senator John Tester sent a letter urging the FBI and BIA to step up their investigation and asked for an update for Not Afraid's family and local communities. I'm Olivia Reingold in Billings, Montana.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
The reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone National Park has led to improved waterway habitat, declining coyote and elk numbers, and an increase in beavers, birds, willow, and aspen. KBOO reporter Melissa Hood has this story.
It's been 25 years since wolves were brought back into Yellowstone National Park, and park officials say the animal's future is on track to continue to be a healthy, contributing member of the Yellowstone family. Park Representative Linda Veres says wolves have a significant role to play in the park's ecosystem. Elk population numbers were very high at the time of reintroduction, and their overgrazing resulted in loss of willow and aspen. Wolves helped bring elk numbers back to normal levels.
With a decrease in elk populations, the willow and aspen had a chance to rebound and recover, which also resulted in bird populations increasing.
After decades of habitat loss and extermination by humans, wolves vanished from their historic territory. Wolves were placed on the endangered species list in 1973, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service designated Greater Yellowstone as a key recovery area. From 1995 to 1997, 41 wild wolves from Canada and Montana were released into the park. The program has been controversial, with hunters concerned about loss of game and ranchers concerned about the safety of livestock. According to the group Defenders of Wildlife, elk populations across Wyoming have gone up in the past 25 years, and less than 1% of livestock numbers have been lost since the reintroduction. Wolf numbers have climbed as well. Veres says as of December 2018, there were about 80 wolves in 9 packs in the park, which she says is a stable population.
The number one cause of mortality in wolves in the park are by other wolves, just in competition for food and for territory.
Park officials have several events planned to commemorate the 25th anniversary, including a weekly series of live broadcasts on Facebook starting in March. Experts will cover topics including the ecological role of wolves in the ecosystem, the global impact of reintroduction, and the future relationship between wolves and people. Details are online at nps.gov/YEL. For KBOO Evening News and Oregon News Service, I'm Melissa Hood.
Experts have confirmed that a painting found hidden inside an Italian gallery wall is an authentic Gustav Klimt piece stolen almost 23 years ago. It's the portrait of a lady. It was one of the world's most sought-after stolen artworks before it was found concealed in a wall in the Rishi Odi Modern Art Gallery. The painting was discovered by two gardeners as they cleared ivy on an exterior wall of the gallery in December. They found a metal panel which opened to reveal a cavity inside with the painting in a bag. An initial inspection indicated that it was Klimt's 1917 work before two experts were appointed to confirm its authenticity. The Pienza prosecutor, Ornella Chica, said at a press conference, quote, It's with no small emotion that I can tell you that the work is authentic, end quote. The theft of the portrait of the lady was discovered on the morning of February 22, 1997, but police believed it had been removed 3 days earlier. Investigators at the time suspected an inside job. The case was reopened in 2016 after the discovery of DNA traces of a thief on the painting's abandoned frame. Police believed the thieves used a fishing line to hook the masterpiece off the wall and pull it up through an open skylight on the roof of the gallery where the frame was discarded. The painting is also considered particularly important because shortly before its disappearance, an art student realized it had been painted over another work previously believed to be lost. The artist had painted over another portrait of a young lady that has not been seen since 1912, making it the only so-called double Klimt known to the art world. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 17th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Melissa Hood, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Sam Bowman. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Claire Rosado. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 6, it's Swingin' Country. At 9, it's Music from the True Vine. Then at 7, it's Grateful Dead and Friends. All these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to the KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Natural Grocers, which is donating